The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban, and you're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. And today we continue reading from the combined July-August 2019 edition of Smithsonian. Speed Demons, a blazing nitromethane-fueled American tale of racing glory, murder, and a son's pursuit of his father's unfinished legacy, by Jeff McGregor. In the middle of the course, over that flying mile, Mickey Thompson's speed was about equal to the muzzle velocity of a bullet fired from a lightly loaded small-caliber pistol, 406.6 miles per hour. This was September 9, 1960, on the Bonneville Salt Flats. He became the fastest man in the world that day, the first American to go over 400 miles per hour, the fastest racer ever on land, unofficially at least. Because to earn the world land speed record, the car has to make two passes. Thompson's car, the Challenger, an 8,000-pound, 3,000-horsepower streamliner with four V8 engines he chalked out on the garage floor, then built with his own hands, broke on the return run. But neither fame, nor glory, nor pride, nor patriotism are bounded by the rules. And that afternoon, under that high Utah sky, Mickey Thompson became a By God American hero in the last great age of the black-and-white news reel. In the middle of nearly the same course, over that same flying mile, under that same Utah sky, Danny Thompson's speed was even higher than his father's, 448.757 miles per hour. This was August 12, 2018, on the Bonneville Salt Flats. Danny became the fastest piston-driven man in the world that day, officially. Thompson's Challenger 2, a 5,200-pound, 6,000-horsepower Dagger with two V8 engines, built by his father's hands and by his own, did not break. It made both runs successfully. But neither fame, nor glory, nor pride, nor patriotism are bounded by the rule books, and Danny Thompson remained not very famous, even as he surpassed his father, the murdered American hero from the last great age of the black-and-white newsreel. This is the story of Mickey Thompson and Danny Thompson and a car. And, okay, right off the top, the whole deal feels like something out of ancient Greece or Norse mythology, or maybe Hollywood. Too big too on the nose, too Shakespearean, all vengeance and reckoning. The son takes up the blade of the fallen father, the murdered king, to honor and make whole and right the great man's fame. The truth of Thompson's father and Thompson's son and that impossibly beautiful car is as old as storytelling. But it's not Sophocles or Wagner. It's not even Inigo Montoya. It's the Beach Boys or Jan and Dean, a kind of piston ring circle, a sunshot folk opera set in Southern California on the western slope of Colorado and under that huge blue Utah sky. And because this is an imperfect world filled with greed and violence, even the blinding high noon dazzle of those snow-white salt flats can't drive out the shadows and the ghosts and the darkness at the heart of the story. Still, this isn't as much about justice or revenge or even closure as it is about a family of racers, racing. Not a reckoning, a reconciliation. When they're running for speed on the flats, you can hear those engines doppering downrange from everywhere in the valley, howling so that even miles away there's something mournful in all that sunlight. And every car and every driver and the whole crazy story of speed and desire echoes down the years until it all feels like centuries ago, because the car is an arrow across time. Marion Lee Mickey Thompson was the hottest hot rod king America ever made, and he remade America in return. Born in 1928 in Southern California, he arrived at the right place at the right moment to ride the first crest of America's post-war car madness. Not much of a student, he was an uncanny natural with cars. He was building them in the backyard from junk parts before he was old enough for a driver's license. He'd run them at Muroc Dry Lake Bed, flat-out, straight-line speed stuff. In the old snapshots, he's a sharp-featured pale kid with an angle-iron crew cut in cuffed dungarees and a white T-shirt. A hot rod genius who barely finished high school as poster boy for all that tire smoking, go fast, SoCal excess. Big engines, wide tires, street rods were a kind of high-performance folk art after the war, a symbol of sudden working-class prosperity and mobility, and hell-for-leather freedom. In Mickey Thompson, all those big American ideas found individual expression in street racing, drag racing, road and off-road racing. He was the hot shoe Paul Bunyan, a young giant out on a new frontier. This is back when hot rods and rock and roll were noisy evidence of social decay and juvenile delinquency, of decadence and premarital sex and parental disrespect, which is how Hollywood framed it in movies like Rebel Without a Cause, all of which is important to remember when you get to the Mickey Thompson biographies. Earnest, well-meant, and well-considered, they're generally straight-line stuff, too. They get you from A to B to C well enough, but if you really want insight into Mickey Thompson, man and myth, you have to find his autobiography. It's a slender little thing from 1964, long out of print. The full title is Challenger, Mickey Thompson's Own Story of His Life of Speed, capital S. And the cover states Thompson wrote the book with automotive and racing historian Griffith Borgeson. The life of speed may be Thompson's, but the voice of the book is surely Borgeson's, written in the gloriously over-the-top style of the early 1960s motoring press. It is not only a florid sort of instep kicking, shucks, lives of the saints, but an entertaining whitewash of the American garage. Historically, a fairly profane corner of American life. It also glosses, or worse, makes colorful, Thompson's habit of punching in the nose those he disagrees with. The book turns out to be a position paper on hot rodding, too, and getting fast cars off the street and onto the drag strip. So here's Mickey Thompson, black-haired and black-tempered, a two-fisted precisionist and self-taught horsepower obsessive, who could, would, and will, can build anything, drive anything, trial and error anything, and then beat you flat with it. He's no hoodlum. In fact, he takes a job as a pressman at the Los Angeles Times to help pay for all the racing and engine building. He rarely sleeps. At night he makes the newspaper, and during the day builds the cars, and manages a drag strip, and raises a family. His wife, Judy, cleans the house and feeds the kids, and dry-fits the pistons on the engine rebuilds before he gets home. She's a motorhead, too, and the children, Lindy and Danny, daughter and son, are racers from the cradle. The whole racer family caught in Dad's planetary wheel spin. They spend every weekend in the station wagon on the way to the drag strip, to the track, to the high, dry desert. He doesn't invent drag racing, but he helps perfect it. Mickey dreams up a thing called the slingshot dragster, a quarter-miler with a driver seated behind the rear axle for better traction. Keep in mind, he's also racing sedans and open-wheelers out at Riverside Racetrack, and down in Long Beach, and driving the length of Mexico in the deadly, legendary Carrera Panamericana. He's always looking for an edge, or maybe the edge itself. He's making a name for himself, driving and building and selling speed parts to other gearheads. He's well known in Southern California. Until he wraps a small body around a pair of V8 engines to make an extraordinary dragster just for the hell of it. Just to see what it can do and maybe find out how fast is fast. Turns out to be so fast, more than 266 miles per hour, It makes him the fastest American ever. And now it's got him the way it got all the others. The hunt for the world land speed record. Out there in the distant shimmer. The first official fastest man on Earth was a Frenchman, Count Gaston de Chasteloup-Labey, driving a Jeantaud battery electric car. Just before the turn of the last century, in 1898, he zoomed along at an incredible 39.25 miles per hour. I pray that the deluge. The Count launched a timeline of dreamers from that day to this. Daredevils and scoundrels on the deserts and beaches of Belgium and England and France, Australia and Africa, California and Utah and Florida, aristocrats and paupers, stuntmen and grease monkeys, pump jockeys, cowboys, and knights of the realm. They ran train-driven streamers, buzzing electrics, and repurposed 12-cylinder aircraft engines as big as garden sheds. Some were beautiful, some were laughable, men and machines both. Some were streamlined, and some no more aerodynamic than a brick. The cars became as famous as the drivers, the Fiat Mephistopheles, the Bluebird, the Chitty Bang Bang, the Green Monster, the Mormon Meteor, the Spirit of America. Henry Ford himself held the record for a couple of weeks in 1904 at 91.37 miles per hour, driving the Arrow. The world's first fastest woman was Dorothy Levitt, a Brit, who drove 91 miles per hour in 1906. By the time World War I had come and gone, the idea of a land speed record had caught the imagination of the modern world, like the race to the poles or a flight across the Atlantic. Every record was a headline. Every record made the newsreels. So did the failures and the crashes and the fatalities. Broken cars and drivers were scattered on the sands of every continent. For decades, the British were best at it. Between the wars, Sir Malcolm Campbell was the 20th century Prometheus. He set record after record in his magnificent Bluebirds, each bigger and faster than the last. He went west to Bonneville and south to Daytona, and year after year, speeds rose as records and his competition fell away. After World War II, cars and drivers were flirting hard with 400 miles per hour, but no one had done it yet, certainly no American. Through the 1950s, the British, wearing their immaculate lab coats and carrying their clipboards and slide rules, continued their million-pound sterling factory mega-projects, each car the product of wind tunnel research and cutting-edge design and engineering. Meanwhile, the Yanks were building backyard streamliners out of war surplus belly tanks. Into which world swaggers Marion Lee Thompson, who then does what only Thompson can do. After that twin-engine dragster of his runs so fast, he hustles home, grabs a piece of chalk, draws the outline of a low, wide quad-engine streamliner on his garage floor, and starts to build. He takes four cast-off Pontiac V8 engines and bends a frame around them, then wraps the whole thing in bodywork so snug his crew has to push him down into the seat like a jack-in-the-box. If it doesn't kill him, it might make him famous. He calls it Challenger, paints it blue, hitches up the trailer, and heads for Utah. He wears old-time motorcycle leathers and a crash helmet like a daredevil being shot from a cannon, goggles, and an oxygen mask straight out of Fahrenheit 451. All of which, at these speeds, is a kind of prayer. The frame is what saves you. The roll cage, the fates. He fires the engine, and 1,000 feet away, you feel the sound as bad pressure on your chest. The course across the salt is about 10 miles long, depending on weather and the season, and razor straight. They measure the flying mile right in the middle. It takes 4 miles just to get the car up to speed. And you can hear it roaring down the whole valley under that impossible Sertlian sky. The entire horizon, perfect white and absolute blue, is heaven's own threshold. Here's Mickey Thompson in his own words, or at least Griffith Borgeson's, to describe it. People often ask how I can shift all four of those transmissions at once, how the linkage is made that makes it possible. When I laid the car out, I didn't attack all four gearboxes at once. I took one, told myself that it had to work, and made it work. Then the next one had to work, so I made brackets and linkage that made it work too. I kept going that way until all four were linked up and working together. I have a knack for sensing optimum leverage points. I have one lever for low and high gears. You pull it all the way back and push it forward for neutral. When you've done that, another lever falls right into your hand. You push it forward in the same plane, and you're in second. Then you pull it back, grab the first lever again, pull it back and slightly to the side, and you're in top gear. It's not too much different from shifting a passenger car, as anyone who has heard Challenger run can tell. I blasted off, and the car felt wonderful. I waited for tires to break loose, and they didn't. The biggest problem had always been getting up to 300 soon enough, which I never had been able to do. But this morning, everything clicked, and I could bear down with my throttle foot. Through the seat of my pants, I sensed the tire diameters, and they were all perfectly uniform, it seemed, right to the thousandth of an inch. I felt for the clutches, and they were locked solid, as they should be. I listened to all the sets of gears, and they all sang in one precise key. I felt out for the distribution of weight from front to rear, and it was perfect. I checked the two tachometers that spoke for the fore and aft pairs of engines. I never had been able to get them to follow each other perfectly. This morning, they did. At 300, they were indicating identical revs. I stayed on the throttle, and at 350, they were still together. Yes. At 375, they told me that the front engines and the rear engines, front wheels and rear wheels, were still turning at the same identical rate. I still stayed on the throttle, and Challenger went like a dream. No more handling problems at all. The car finally was sorted out, and I had the combination that worked. For the first time, I didn't have to lift my throttle foot. Long before I rolled to a stop, I knew that I'd broken 400, and while we refueled, and Judy and Fritz and the whole gang were bursting with joy, the official time came over the field phone, 406.60 miles per hour. Fastest man alive. But to make it official, he has to turn the car around in under an hour and drive back the other way. The average of those two runs will be what gets him into the record book. The car breaks. Something in that impossible Rube Goldberg sequence of engines and linkages gives way. He doesn't hold the official record. He's not certified. But in those grainy black-and-white film clips, he's the fastest man alive. And he's an American driving American equipment. It didn't kill him, so it makes him famous. The story is all blue sky and bootstraps, so far. Picture 1960 America as a gleaming TV sitcom kitchen of that time, bright with the latest labor-saving devices, and Formica and Chrome. A tidy, aspirational reflection of the new middle class to which we, or at least television advertisers, aspired. Now picture Mickey Thompson crashing through that kitchen wall in his fire-breathing supercar. Without even setting the official record, Mickey Thompson becomes a national sensation, the flip side of America's prim post-war suburban self-image. He is brash, fearless, inexhaustible. He is sleepless, ingenious, ambitious. He can't stop himself. He designs cars on cocktail napkins. Keeps a notepad in bed. You never know when you'll need to sketch out some shock absorber schematics. It's not just street rod magic now, either. It's big-ticket sponsorships and factory deals with Detroit. The year before, he had left the Los Angeles Times. He builds open-wheel racers to challenge the old guard at the Indianapolis 500. He builds off-road racers to challenge the deserts of Baja California. He builds a national speed parts business and a national tire business. He builds another car to challenge the world land speed record. He builds a series of stadium truck races. Mickey Thompson builds a Mickey Thompson empire. He's an engineer, a manufacturer, a driver, a promoter, an impresario. It's hard to sensationalize him because he's so straight-up sensational. Out of the 1960s and into the 1970s and 80s, Mickey Thompson is as big a name as there is in motorsports. He grows out the crew cut, gets divorced, remarries. The collars get a little wider, and so does he. But the determination and innovation never flag. He'll beat you every which way and any way he can. Remember, this is all happening across the same arc of history that gets us from Benny Goodman to Woodstock to Prince, and from Korea to Quezon to the surface of the moon. Mickey Thompson is supremely adaptive, from success to success, and more important, failure to failure, he manages to thrive. So even when he's not, the public thinks of Thompson as the fastest American ever. By 1965, jet power dominates the world land speed record, and American Craig Breedlove holds the absolute record at 600-plus miles per hour in the Spirit of America Sonic 1. So Thompson puts his streamliner on the trailer and heads back to the Salt Flats in 1968. Not because he can outrun a jet, but because he's Thompson. A lighter car, narrower, twin-engine fore and aft with a body like the fuselage of a wingless fighter plane. The car can still win the official piston-driven record. But he's rained out. As has been rumored, only God can stop Thompson. The car goes into storage. By the mid-1980s, he's too busy, even by his own overachieving standards, so he takes on a partner for the stadium race events. Imagine the Los Angeles Coliseum decked out as a winding dirt track for off-road trucks, with tight turns and spectacular jumps and whoop-de-doos and mud flying and the noise and the crashes and the beer sales, and you'll see it. It's a fan favorite from the first green flag. The partner is Michael Goodwin, a successful, charismatic former concert promoter who runs a Supercross series nearly identical in its appeal and specifications to Thompson's truck series. Stadium dirt tracks and high-speed racing with lots of thrills. Two wheels instead of four. They'll run their two companies together. Goodwin will take over some of the administrative chores. On paper, it's a match made in heaven. From the beginning, there's trouble. Goodwin is a tall, smart, look-at-me type with a line of grandstanding rock and roll patter. Thompson would still rather build something than brag about it. They're at odds immediately. Within the first few months, Thompson realizes that Goodwin isn't paying out what the company owes to Thompson or to anyone else. Goodwin stonewalls. Thompson sues. Goodwin takes the case all the way to the California State Court of Appeals. He loses. He owes Thompson more than $500,000, all of it gone, unaccounted for. He declares bankruptcy. This takes years. In a different story with different characters, maybe that's where the matter ends. A court ruling and a money judgment, and all the lawyers shake hands because business is business, even after a bankruptcy. Happens all the time. Not this time. Danny Thompson answered his phone early on the morning of March 16, 1988. Somebody from my dad's office called and said, "Something's happened up in Bradbury. We don't know what it is." Danny drove fast up the freeway from Huntington Beach and found his father's street cordoned off. The local news helicopters were hovering overhead. Mickey Thompson, famous American racer, 59 years old, and his second wife, Trudy, 41, had been shot to death in their own driveway. It was a tabloid celebrity murder, in the old SoCal style, a preamble to O.J., all that grainy aerial video and the telephoto newspaper images from 1,000 feet away. There's money and jewelry conspicuous at the scene. It's not a botched robbery. It's a hit, an assassination. The neighbors hear the shots and the screaming and witness two men fleeing down the hill. For days, Thompson had been warning his family about Michael Goodwin's subtle and not-so-subtle threats of revenge, of violence. "He's taken everything I've got. He's destroying me," Goodwin told two friends at a 1988 dinner. according to court documents. I'm going to take him out. But there was no case against Goodwin, no physical evidence he had anything to do with the murders. Years passed. It was perhaps the most famous cold case in America. Investigators came and went from the Los Angeles police and the county sheriff's and the district attorney's office and got nowhere. But Colleen Thompson Campbell, Mickey's sister, the politically astute former mayor of San Juan Capistrano, never gave up. She kept pressuring the authorities for better, broader, deeper investigations. She wouldn't let anyone forget. A re-canvassing of the original witnesses eventually revealed what seemed like an unrelated comment from years earlier. A man matching Goodwin's description had been seen parked on the street near the Thompson home in Bradbury several days before the killings. That was enough to reopen the case. The trial began in November 2006. In January 2007, a Los Angeles County jury convicted Michael Goodwin on two counts of first-degree murder for having engineered the murders for hire of Mickey and Trudy Thompson. He was sentenced to consecutive life sentences. His 2015 appeal was denied, and he remains at the Richard J. Donovan State Prison in San Diego, California. The gunmen have never been found or even identified. In 1988, Mickey had wanted to dust off Challenger 2 and rewrite the record books with the Thompson's name. He had even asked Danny to drive the car for him. He was murdered a month later. What do you do when your own father is a character out of American mythology? How long is the shadow he casts? Danny Thompson is a racer. It's in his blood. You're born with it. You're stuck with it. It's indefinable, the one thing you can never outrun, an identity as much a matter of chromosomes as of character. It is a psycho-spiritual condition in which you hear exhaust noise as music and connect to the physical universe with hands at 10 and 2 and with an increasing pressure exerted at the tip of the right big toe. Danny Thompson is his father's son, so Danny raced. Motocross, formula cars, off-road buggies, and trucks. He was good at it, too. Won a lot of races. Won championships. Of course, the irony is Mickey forbade it. From the time he yanked Danny out of a quarter midget racer at the age of 9 or 10, Mickey was adamant that Danny not race for a living. Mickey understood too well the dangers, refused to sponsor him or help him in any way. So for a long time, Danny Thompson raced in secret. They were close, but both were stubborn and headstrong. You see the family album now, the two of them getting the boat ready to go water skiing, or leaning on a fender of a car, and you see Mickey Thompson, American icon and force of nature, standing with a slender kid wearing a shy half-smile. That's why it felt like the end of one thing and the beginning of another, a new chapter for the whole family, when Mickey asked Danny to drive the second Challenger. We hope you've enjoyed today's edition of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.